The list of school shooting massacres continues to grow as this past week in Nashville, Tennessee, three children and three adults were slaughtered by a person who was allowed to legally purchase seven guns in spite of being treated for an emotional disorder. One of the ideas that's been a part of this too frequent now after the killing debate has been they're called red flag laws. It's a process which has been implemented by 19 states along with the District of Columbia. So why not more states? Why not on a federal level? Joining us to explore this idea is a professor of constitutional law and elections at St. Francis College, as well as an author whose books include Presidential Power and the American Political System, Dr. Frank Sorrentino. How are you today, sir?
Doing great. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Two websites. We have them linked at our homepage, too, drfrankmsorrentino.com. Learn more about the educational opportunities of St. Francis College, sfc.edu. Just for the basics, for the person listening right now, Doctor, what are red flag laws?
Well, they are extreme risk protection orders, which attempt to anticipate dangerous people that they may commit crimes and then seize their weapons before such an act may occur.
Now, there is a situation or a law that's similar to this, but it's after an action. We have in many states, New Jersey being one of those, someone who is indicted on domestic violence charges. They're told or forced to surrender their guns. Is there any fair comparison between those two ideas? Does one allow the other?
I think they're basically different. The American jurisprudence system is based upon if you commit a crime, you risk losing your liberty. The red flag laws are anticipating crime. And certainly if someone has threatened someone, that's a crime, and they can lose their liberty. They can not only go to jail, but they could certainly have their weapons forfeited. Those are all legitimate outcomes of the traditional judicial system.
What is it among, the Constitution's Second Amendment, at least visually, looks very simple. How much more deeper have court cases explored and expanded what the meaning is of the Second Amendment?
Well, the D.C. versus Heller case is the critical case that most people cite. And Antonin Scalia wrote the majority opinion in that case. And what he focused on was that the Second Amendment was the right of self-protection and that everyone has that right implicitly in the Constitution. So therefore, a person should have what means are reasonable to defend themselves against a legitimate threat. So the idea of a militia is a historical concept which basically included everyone in the community. There was no standing army at the time the Second Amendment was written. So the Heller case basically says, do people have a right to defend themselves? And if they do, then they have to have adequate means to do so. He didn't say that you could have whatever weapon. He certainly said reasonable weapons and weapons that would be commensurate with the threat that people face.
And that's actually an offshoot of what had been the original case. I guess maybe you'd say the father to Heller was Parker versus D.C.
Yeah, there are a couple of cases. There's also the Miller case, which all talk about that the Constitution is basically based upon a John Locke Second Treatise on Civil Government, which basically says that people live in a state of nature and they join government for the purposes of protection and the ensuring of certain rights. Among the rights are life, liberty, and his term, property, which Jefferson converted to pursuit of happiness, meaning the same basic notion. But if you have a right of life, you can't be totally dependent on the government to protect it. They can assist, but that you have always the reserve rights to do so.
I reference Parker versus D.C. because in that initial case, That was challenging the District of Columbia's Firearms Control Regulation Act from 1975, had three parts to it, banned the registration of handguns, prohibited the carrying of unlicensed handguns, or as defined, any other deadly or dangerous weapon capable of being concealed, and required that lawfully stored firearms be disassembled or locked to prevent firing. Heller took, the Court of Appeals in 2007 agreed with number two, eliminated number one and number three, and that's what advanced into the Heller decision. So the question becomes, was Heller just basically addressing handguns only, not long barrel rifles or AR-15s?
It's basically dealing with handguns. Heller himself was a law enforcement official, and he had the right to use a handgun, and he was told that he couldn't do it, he had to disassemble it, and so the Heller case is the fruition of that common law development that Scalia argued was basic.
Dr. Frank Sorrentino, professor of constitutional law and elections at St. Francis College, author whose books include Presidential Power and the American Political System, drfrankmsorrentino.com, and St. Francis's website, sfc.edu, or listening to Issues and Ideas. Constitutionally, red flag laws, do they stand up against the test of the Second Amendment? Do they fall to the Second Amendment, or is this a case-by-case basis? Because every state right now, at least, has different red flag law definitions.
Yes, they're slightly different, but the basic red flag laws have passed, particularly the New York state law, which is the one that was challenged. Unfortunately for the New York state law, the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in the state, said that they were re-challenging the victory that the Supreme Court had given them. So it's quite up in the air to some degree. But for the most part, the courts have been supportive of it. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate arguments against them. But the courts have generally allowed within the state court system, and the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled affirmatively that they can be constitutional.
This might be oversimplification on my part, but if we are guaranteed as citizens to have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if someone is imposing a threat, as I mentioned, the Nashville shooter had been undergoing professional treatment for an emotional disorder, I mean, you can make the argument it's up to the medical profession to step forward and say, "This is I have someone with a problem here. Don't allow them to do A, B, C, or D." But what in the Constitution prevents prevention, I guess would be the question.
Well, the critical area is the violation of the criminal code. Now, when we talk about mentally ill individuals, there was a period of time, in matter of fact, most of American history, where we were able to institutionalize people. Now, there was supposed to be some kind of due process. But in the past, it was basically allocated to medical individuals who were given the authority to make that determination. Subsequently, we've rechanged a lot of those laws, and it suggested that unless a person is in extreme harm to themselves or to others, that there has to be some court proceedings. And that is still on the books. So if an individual is mentally ill, you can provide evidence that that person is a danger. And usually when people are engaged in activities, they make threatening speeches, conversations, they engage in hostile actions, and many of those actions can be the predicate for institutionalizing. As I said, recently that's become extremely difficult, and most states have made it very, very difficult. New York, for example, large numbers of homeless, many of them who are mentally ill, many of them who are endangering themselves are allowed because the state is unwilling to pursue those options, which could be difficult because of the judicial system.
You mentioned due process, and that's been one of the points of argument against red flag laws, that in many of the states, mentioned 19 plus D.C., have some sort of one level or another of red flag laws. In some of the cases, a medical professional does not even have to be in the courtroom. They can just submit an affidavit declaring this person to be troubled and should not have possession of firearms. If it was mandatory, let's just say in a perfect world, because even though this is not possible under the current political state of affairs, but let's say a federal red flag law was passed where everyone had to be physically present in the courtroom for both sides, defense and prosecution, I guess we'd say, can question them and respond and go back and forth. Would that alleviate some of the constitutional questions about red flag laws?
Chris, I think you've put your finger on the most important issue. These red flag laws are mostly ex parte proceedings, and the party who is target is not there, may not even be aware that a proceeding has happened. The verification, the cross-examination of witnesses, the motivation of the witnesses, the competence of the witnesses, that is basically the violation of due process, and that's where most people find the red flag laws wanting, and wanting significantly.
So it certainly is not going to, it cannot be under a judicial oversight, a gun grab, like some people are trying to make red flag laws sound to be, but simple adjustments, as you heard Dr. Sorrentino refer to, can maybe solidify a constitutionally justifiable prevention of the tragedies that we are seeing over and over and over again. Learn more about Dr. Sorrentino's work and his writing. Of course, he is the author whose books include Presidential Power and the American Political System, DrFrankMSorrentino.com. We have the link at our homepage. He is a constitutional law professor as well as professor of elections at St. Francis College. SFC.edu is their website. Dr. Frank Sorrentino, thank you so much for your insight on this very important issue.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you.